Bloodstream is a Believe original.
A 360-degree look
at the bleeding disorders community.
The developments, the history,
the news,
and the people who shaped our world.
Bloodstream is brought to you by the National Hemophilia Foundation and created by Believe Limited.
Happy listening!
Hello and welcome to Bloodstream, episode 5, October 17th, 2016. I am your host, Patrick James Lynch. We have got a packed episode this month, including my sit-down with the, oh man, choose your word, impressive, dedicated, tireless, huge-hearted HIV/AIDS and hemophilia advocate Jeannie White-Ginder. We've got a few great pieces to cover in our like, share, comment segment, some intriguing trending topics to get to, in a segment previously known as Headlines. So I want to dive right in, but I do first need to say a big thank you to everyone who has left us a review on iTunes. Those reviews truly do help more people find the program. So if this is something you enjoy, if this is a podcast that you think people in the bleeding disorders community should know about, please share it far and wide across social media, email people, subscribe to us on your podcast player of choice, but also leave a review on iTunes. It goes a long way, and we truly do appreciate it. All right, well, there's not a moment to waste, so here we go. Trending topics. Every month, there are dozens of important, exciting, and meaningful stories that affect our community. We'll take a close look at three of these during our like, share, comment segment, but first, we'll glance at some of the other trending topics from around the community. And as always, to learn more about any of our trending topic stories, check out the program notes for this episode in your podcast player, or find them in the program notes of episode 5 on bloodstreampod.com/episodes. The National Hemophilia Foundation launched a new series of educational webinars. The first kicks off this Wednesday, October 19th, and is titled Prophylaxis, Teens, and Adherence. To sign up or learn more about this series, click on the Events and Educational Programs tab at hemophilia.org. The Nationwide Children's Hospital in Columbus, Ohio released a story this month on Voxel Bay, a first-of-its-kind virtual reality experience developed by the hemophilia team and design experts from Nationwide Children's and students from The Ohio State University. The sports world taught me that you always got to say The Ohio State. I don't remember why. The pilot study, funded by a grant from NHF, is currently testing the feasibility of integrating the virtual reality technology into the clinic setting. The team is also collecting preliminary data on usability and likability from parents, patients, and nurses. And if you follow the link in the program notes, you'll find a page on Nationwide Children's website with a video that's demonstrating Voxel Bay in use. And I gotta say, it's pretty cool. Hemophilia News Today reports that a team of Chinese researchers may have discovered a relatively simple way to identify women who carry the gene causing hemophilia A by utilizing a technique called genetic linkage analysis. I'll be honest, it's kind of complicated. I didn't fully grasp it myself. You can learn more about it if you follow the links in the program notes. But here's the bottom line. If the identification method is proven effective, it could potentially lead to an increase in diagnosis and help inform family planning decisions for those tested. It's pretty cool. Here's a fun trending topic for you. A Korean research team has developed a self-sealing hemostatic needle that will stop bleeding from the vein once the needle is removed, which for all of us who infuse, as you know, when you remove the needle, immediately the vein starts to bleed out, right? And you gotta put pressure on it right away. Well, they have found a way to stop that by leveraging a component extracted from muscles. And no, I don't mean muscles like Arnold Schwarzenegger muscles. I mean like ocean muscles. No word yet on when this unexpected development in needle technology may be widely available, but the researchers believe that it could have long-term implications in hemophilia, diabetes, cancer treatment, catheter use, all thanks to muscles. And finally, in response to the growing need for personalization of outcomes, a team of hematologists recently reviewed two tools used for patient-reported outcomes, which is sometimes referred to as PROs, patient-reported outcomes. And they identified these two tools as, and this is a direct quote from the article, more directly addressing the need for personalization of outcome measurement in hemophilia. And essentially, these tools empower patients to work with their care team on setting personal outcome goals related to their condition, care, treatment, and total functionality and marking progress along the way. You can read more about those findings and all of our trending topic stories by checking out the program notes in the description of this episode or by going to bloodstreampod.com/episodes. Coming up in a bit is my sit-down with Jeannie White-Ginder, but up next in our Like, Share, Comment segment, we'll take a look at some recent stories on physical fitness and charity, the need for sleep, and some of the realities of present-day HIV/AIDS, both encouraging and, well, not so encouraging. That, followed again by my sit-down with iconic Jeannie White-Ginder, is next, right after this word from our presenting sponsor. This episode is brought to you by our presenting sponsor, Stop the Bleeding. Stop the Bleeding is a comedic mockumentary web series about a dysfunctional bleeding disorders nonprofit organization. The cast of goofy characters tries to do good in the community and usually succeeds by accident. I may be a little biased as the show's creator, head writer, and star, but I do think it does a pretty good job of using comedy and narrative content to tell some important stories about what it means to live in the world of bleeding disorders. You can check out all 29 episodes, including our most recent 8 episodes from our season at Camp I Don't Wanna Bleed, by visiting stbhemo.com. That's stbhemo.com. For this episode's Like piece, we highlight the panoply of stories from the last month about bleeding disorders and bike riding. And yes, I did just work panoply into a sentence here on Bloodstream. So, here are those stories. First, the Hemophilia Federation of America's annual Gears for Good National Ride took place last month, with a couple dozen community members riding 156 miles and raising over $130,000 for HFA's Helping Hands program, a program that assists community families with urgent and emergency needs. And a regional 50-mile ride took place just this past weekend in Ohio. Next up, on episode 2 of Bloodstream, you might recall we featured Barry Hardy's Wheels for the World cross-country cycling fundraiser that kicked off on July 17th. Well, 2 months and 5,000 miles later, Wheels for the World is reporting on their Facebook page that Barry's fifth cross-country ride brought in $52,166 for Save One Life. Save One Life, by the way, is an organization serving community in the developing world, and their Facebook page and website are both worth checking out. In total, in the last 5 years, Barry's cycled over 19,000 miles on these TransCon rides alone and raised over $220,000. Truly impressive, Barry. And according to Barry, he is not done yet. A huge congratulations to Mr. Barry Hardy, to Save One Life, and to the greatest beneficiary of their joint efforts, those community members in the developing world who benefit from Save One Life's work. And lastly, a news outlet in England reported on September 30th that record-setting professional racing cyclist Alex Dowsett, who lives with hemophilia, has launched Little Bleeders, a charity committed to helping children with bleeding disorders engage in sports, particularly swimming and cycling, and active lifestyles. In speaking about his motivation for starting Little Bleeders, the 28-year-old professional athlete said, quote, "As the only elite athlete with the blood condition, I feel a responsibility to support others with the condition, but also to help the next generation of people with the condition, as I will definitely not be the last athlete with hemophilia." You can learn more about Little Bleeders by visiting littlebleeders.com, and you can follow Alex on Twitter, at Alex Dowsett, A-L-E-X-D-O-W-S-E-T-T. Okay, and I lied, sorry. There's one more amazing bike riding story from this past month, because like I told you, it was Panoply Month. A story published in the Greeley Tribune featured community member Kyle Haas, a young adult bike rider from Colorado, who has completed 2 years in a row a 7-day, 500-mile ride over mountain passes. The article has some great photos of Kyle on his ride as well, which I recommend you check out. I'm inspired by Kyle's rides and by Alex using his platform to help the next generation of Little Bleeders lead active, healthy lives, by Barry continuing this remarkable annual journey, and by seeing how much money the Gears for Good riders were able to raise for families with urgent needs here in the States. Okay, that completes our panoply of recaps on the panoply of stories on bleeding disorders and bike rides. Remember in school, or for those of you who are in school, remember recently when a teacher would say, don't be afraid to raise your hand if you're struggling or if you have a question about something, because if you do, someone else in here probably does too. You know what I'm talking about? So that's what I'm recalling to present this month's share piece, because it's not necessarily a big news story or a topic of interest this very moment, but it's something that I find continually challenging personally, and I'm pretty sure that I'm not alone on this. Getting a good full night's sleep. In a real layman's experiment, as I was preparing this piece, I did a quick Google search to find news stories related to sleep and filtered the results to show me only news stories about sleep from the past week. After scanning quickly through 40 pages of results, and yeah, there were even more, and seeing headlines again and again like health effects of sleep deprivation add up and poor sleep can negatively impact a woman's heart, along with list after list after list of tips to improve sleep, one thing became abundantly clear. There is a big need to address how well and for how long we sleep. But don't just take it from me and my little layman's experiment. In February, the CDC stated that according to their research, 33% of American adults don't get enough sleep. And for many demographics, by the way, that number was significantly higher. It's also worth pointing out that the study identified 7 hours per night as enough and did not explore with any depth quality of sleep. Additionally, for people like me, and I'm guessing many of you, who live with chronic pain, or for those managing acute pain, pain-related sleep loss is a major problem. According to the 2015 Sleep in America poll conducted by the National Sleep Foundation, on any given week, 57% of Americans are managing either chronic or acute pain and managing how that impacts their ability to get a good night's rest. So getting a proper night's sleep is something that affects everybody. And again, for those of us living with chronic pain or other health considerations, it can be that much more challenging. And now I've got some good news and I got some bad news for you. The bad news is that there's no magic pill. No secret sauce, no ancient ritual to solve all of our combined sleep problems. Perhaps if anyone bumps into a genie who offers 3 wishes, you can consider changing that. But barring bumping into a genie who can magically change our cultural nationwide sleep issues, there's still some light at the end of the tunnel. The good news is that there is no shortage of credible resources that we can use to help us identify individually how we can improve our night's sleep. So what I would like to share with you this month is a short list that we here at Bloodstream compiled of resources to help you get a better night's sleep. The list is posted to the Bloodstream blog at bloodstreampod.com and includes a variety of tools from highly regarded institutions that can be used to help you get more sleep. So check out the Bloodstream blog and start sleeping better tonight. And hey, if you find something that works particularly well for you, share it with us by email, mailbag@bloodstreampod.com, or tweet at us @bloodstreaminfo, or tweet at me and tell me about it @PJLynch. And for our comment piece this month, I want to spotlight a story I saw pretty widely circulated across social media. It's about a 44-year-old British man with HIV who might be cured, and you can't see it, but I'm using air quotes here, cured of HIV after the virus was rendered undetectable in his blood following a new treatment protocol currently being tested in a study out of England. So let me give this proper context before presenting a couple things that come to mind. And to be completely clear, I am not an HIV/AIDS expert. I can imagine those listening to this podcast who have HIV or AIDS or who are experts on HIV/AIDS might phrase something differently or emphasize certain things that I am not. And I welcome that feedback and where appropriate would love to include that in future episodes. So by all means, send it my way. But my goal here is to communicate this story accurately and contextualize it against a broad perspective of AIDS in 2016 for a general, mainly American audience. So here it goes. The United Kingdom's National Institute for Health Research is leading a study comprised of 50 patients with HIV. All 50 patients will receive antiretroviral therapy, or ART, a conventional, commonly used therapy that suppresses HIV in the body. Then half of those patients will receive medication designed to force the virus out of essentially hiding places within the body by stimulating even the most dormant cells. Additionally, these patients will also receive two vaccines, which are designed to boost the immune system so that it can attack and destroy the now exposed virus. The two-step awaken-then-destroy technique has been given the, I'll say, pretty cool name of kick and kill. And the logic of it, even to a layperson like me, seems sound. And there is some precedence for this kick and kill approach to be effective when used in conjunction with ART. In 2006, Timothy Ray Brown appeared to be cured, and I'm using those air quotes again, of the virus after receiving chemotherapy and whole body radiation for acute myeloid leukemia, followed by a bone marrow transplant from a donor with natural immunity to HIV. So, after Brown, who's also, by the way, known by the TV-ready nickname of the Berlin patient, underwent all that while also being on ART, 11 years later, he holds the title of the only person who can claim to be cured, so to speak, of HIV. Okay, back to our anonymous British subject. So just because that the virus in this man has been rendered undetectable, it doesn't mean it has definitely been destroyed entirely. Unlike Brown, the Berlin man, other people with HIV have experienced a rebound of the virus after going as many as 5 years HIV-free following bone marrow transplants. Without a doubt, this news about this anonymous British man's rendering undetectable levels of HIV in his blood, without a doubt, it's encouraging for the study, but for a study that hasn't even finished enrollment at the time of this recording, the most recent articles that we found stated that 39 of the 50 patients thus far have been enrolled. It's far from conclusive evidence. In fact, the consortium of research teams assembled for this trial began their work to find a cure for HIV 6 years ago and do not expect any results from the trial to be ready before 2018. So, in other words, this is a step in the journey, not necessarily the breakthrough moment. And I'm not a unique voice on this point, with BBC News, Popular Science, and numerous other outlets publishing response pieces to this widely circulated story that emphasize the need to manage expectations and allow for the scientific process of this study to play out before any of us get too excited about this potential therapy. As stated by one credible expert, there has been such a history of false optimism and false hope with HIV. So it seems like there's enough articles circulating on the reasons that while this headline about a man cured of HIV is engaging and certainly encouraging for this study, it's not the full story. And one could argue, some have, it's a little misleading. Either way, it signifies that this study is definitely one worth following. But the other point that this brings up for me, and it's something that today's sit-down guest, Jeannie White Ginder, and I spoke about off mic, the fight to stop the spread of AIDS has not ended. Yes, there are encouraging headlines about treatment developments such as this one. Yes, Magic Johnson is alive and well, and it can be easy to think that the AIDS pandemic is over. It's not. It's simply quieter. Has progress been made in the treatment and management of HIV/AIDS? Absolutely. Are there exciting treatments and potential cures being worked on? Sure are. But let me just read you a few sobering statistics from AMFAR, the American Foundation for AIDS Research, an organization whose inaugural fundraiser was co-hosted by actress Elizabeth Taylor and Jeannie White Ginder's son, Ryan White. So a couple stats from AMFAR. In 2015, worldwide, 36.7 million people were living with HIV. In 2015, worldwide, 2.1 million people were newly infected with HIV. 150,000 of those under the age of 15. Every day, about 5,753 people contract HIV. That's about 240 people an hour. And in case you're thinking that while this is a big ongoing worldwide problem, but not specifically a United States problem, think again. Approximately 1.1 million Americans are living with HIV/AIDS, and more than 50,000 become infected with HIV every year. 50,000, 50. And perhaps even more startling, 25% of those newly infected are between the ages of 13 and 24. That means at least one teenager or young adult in this country is infected with HIV every hour of every day. And I'm not running through these numbers to scare you or to be dramatic. I'm stating these numbers because they scare me. They're dramatic and they are shocking to me. And for that reason, I want to understand them. Have we gotten complacent because treatment has gotten strong and consistent? Has product development and chronic care management made HIV/AIDS less scary and therefore less talked about? Are we just tired of it? Why are teens and young adults becoming infected with HIV in the United States at these rates? If we compare the spread of HIV in the U.S. today to, say, Zika, I just stated in 2015 there were 50,050 new cases of HIV in the U.S. To date, there have been 3,818 cases of Zika reported to the CDC. And one big asterisk on that figure, only 105 of those cases were acquired domestically, and all of those were in Florida. Sorry, Florida. The rest are labeled as travel-related cases. If news broke today that a chronic, life-threatening virus called the human immunodeficiency virus was infecting, on our soil, 50,000 Americans per year, including 12,500 teenagers and people under the age of 25, can you imagine the degree of urgency that would surround stopping that spread? Well, maybe if we look back 25 or 30 years, we know exactly what that would look like. When I sat down with Jeannie Weikinder, she had just returned from a trip to Georgia, and even she was startled to learn about the rampant spread of HIV in the particular part of Georgia that she was visiting. So in honor of Jeannie's appearance on this episode, in honor of the work her son Ryan White did to educate about and destigmatize HIV/AIDS, and in honor of the tens of thousands of people with hemophilia and their loved ones who contracted HIV through contaminated product, just like Ryan, let us remember the fight is not over. 25% of new cases of HIV in the U.S. in 2015 occurred in people 13 to 24. 25%. These are children and young adults. Let's not forget that the battle is not yet won. There is still much more work to do. We'll talk about that work and much more next in our sit-down segment with Jeannie Weikinder, but first, this word from our presenting sponsor. Once again, this episode of Bloodstream is brought to you by Stop the Bleeding. Now, I accept you've been busy listening to everything we have to say here on Bloodstream and you haven't had a chance to go to stbhemo.com yet. That's fine, you're still hanging out with us, we understand that. But once you are done with Bloodstream today, head over to stbhemo.com to check out the hilarious and award-winning comedic web series about bleeding disorders. And in just a couple of weeks, we will be releasing our most recent season, season 6, all 8 episodes entirely in Spanish as well. So head over to stbhemo.com to check out what my mom calls her favorite web series. You know when the news celebrates the birthday of a cartoon character or a brand's icon? It's the 10th anniversary of Mr. Clean! I never much care for that. Just as a general rule, I'm not a big fan of celebrating the birthday of non-living things or inanimate objects. Something kind of just seems, I don't know, seems weird to me. Happy birthday, local post office! Happy birthday, Fred Flintstone! I don't know, seems strange. But I guess there's an exception to all rules. USA Today celebrated its 25th birthday in part by assembling a list of 25 people who moved the American world between 1982 and 2007. It's a pretty cool list, I gotta say. It's almost a time capsule with a lot of major figures on there. Number 24 on that list is Matthew Shepard, the 21-year-old college student whose murder brought waves of attention to hate crimes and homophobia in the United States. Number 21 on that list is Steve Irwin. Hey, bet you didn't see that coming. Remarkably, last month marked 10 years since the crocodile hunter was killed by a stingray. 10 years. It seems like that was much more recent. Number 13, Michael J. Fox. Number 12, Terry Schiavo. Number 11, Oprah. Number 10 is Mother Teresa. It's an impressive list of people. And sitting at number 8, right in between Pope John Paul II and the man who stood his ground protesting in favor of democracy before tanks and Tiananmen Square, right between those two legendary human figures, is Ryan White. When a 13-year-old Indiana boy with AIDS court case for readmittance into school garnered national, then international attention as not only an important civil rights case, but as a watershed moment in how we understood HIV as a virus, Ryan White and his family faced seemingly unsurmountable opposition, discrimination, and hate. But rather than use that as an excuse to return the anger and hate, Ryan, ever composed, ever steady, moved through the 5.5 years of life he had left with grace, dignity, compassion, and an altruistic sense of purpose, traveling the country and the world, speaking on behalf of others infected with HIV and suffering from AIDS. Ryan died April 8, 1990, and in the 26 years since his death, his torch and his work have been carried by his remarkable mother, Jeannie White Ginder. In this sit-down, Jeannie and I discuss Ryan's legacy, the inclusion of the hemophilia community into San Francisco's renowned AIDS Memorial Grove, their partnership with the HIV Story Project, and the recognition of the hemophilia community planned for the Grove's World AIDS Day ceremony this coming December 1st. If you've never heard Jeannie speak before, you're in for a treat. She is one of the most grounded, sincere, plain-speaking, and passionate activists and humans I know. I'm proud to consider her a friend and to bring you this sit-down. Enjoy. Hi, Jeannie.
Hi, Patrick.
How are you doing this morning?
I'm doing good.
Well, I guess it's technically afternoon now, isn't it? So, Jeannie, we're here in your home in Florida. I don't know if people realize that you are no longer in Indiana. When did you move down to Florida?
Oh, gosh, probably around 99. We moved here to Florida, in Leesburg, Florida.
And what brought you down here?
My parents, kind of. My parents live here, and we just decided that we wanted to kind of retire, I think, and maybe part-time, and where I could still work and fly out of Orlando, and it'd be simple, not a bad commute, and plus a lot of nonstop flights.
Right. It's important. I mean, yeah, you're on the road a lot.
You travel a lot. Yes.
How much are you traveling these days? What was your summer like?
Very, very hectic over the summer. You know, it depends on September, October, and the fall time. I'm really busy towards World AIDS Day. And then after the first of the year, I have like usually one or two a month. So, you know, I have some downtime too, which I really like.
Yeah, it's almost seasonal in a way where it kind of ebbs and flows. Mm-hmm. how busy you get.
Yeah, because I have a lot of hobbies I like to do with scrapbooking and yard artwork and my garden. And I have a lot of things that I like to do. And not enough time to do them.
When you say scrapbooking too, I think it's important to make clear you take scrapbooking very seriously. It's not, you know, people might think, oh, you put pictures in an album, but no, it's far more intricate than that. How would you describe the way in which you scrapbook?
I think I kind of like to design pages myself. I have about 40. For years, I had put aside all Ryan's newspaper clippings and so forth and just kind of stacked them up and thinking one day I'm going to scrapbook these. And it was, here I am, I'm almost 70 years old, and I started about 10 years ago, finally scrapbooking Ryan's life. And I got about 40 of them now. And I scrapbook with a bunch of girls, and which is really a lot of fun. It gives you time to get away and
absolutely.
be kind of being waited on. And we scrapbook for 3 and 4 days at straight. So it's fun.
And you've taken it beyond just Ryan's story as well, because I noticed in your scrapbooks now we have a lot about Andrea as well. You have stuff with Roy and the family and some friends. So it seems like it's become a way to sort of chronicle life in general for you as well. Is that accurate?
Yeah, scrapbooking is a life story, really, and it tells my whole life from the time Ryan was born and Andrea was born and the kids growing up, from Ryan having hemophilia to having AIDS, and then Ryan's passing, and then marrying Roy and continuing Andrea, and now she's a school teacher and coaches volleyball and soccer, so now I continue to have things to scrapbook.
And the scrapbooks are also, some of them are at the Children's Museum in Indiana, is that right?
Yeah, the Children's Museum keep 3, and when I go up there, I usually speak every day at the Children's Museum, and then when I'm not speaking, I sit at a table and share my scrapbook and share my stories with other people.
So I should clarify, too, so Ryan is included in a Power of Children exhibit that the Indianapolis, Indiana Children's Museum has. That features him, Anne Frank, and Ruby Bridges. And you're up there about 4 times a year?
Yes, 4 times a year they bring me.
And you tell your story, and you have the scrapbook available for people to come by. And we were laughing a little bit yesterday about now people in Ryan's age bracket that have their own kids, and it's a little bit of a trip down memory lane. Because Ryan's room is decorated the way his room was, so there's a real, like, mid-1980s feel to the whole experience, which I imagine for his peers and bringing their kids to it must feel like a travel through time in a little bit of a way.
Yeah, I mean, these are people that are sharing Ryan's story with their own kids, and it's items in Ryan's room, which is all the authentic items. I mean, it's not duplicates or anything. I donated Ryan's bedroom in its entirety, and they created an exhibit out of it. So it's really kind of cool to hear people sharing their stories with, oh, I had that when I was a young kid, or, you know, we did that when I was a young kid. So, but it's a generation, I think, that is being reintroduced to Ryan White.
And Heather, who was his best friend there when you guys moved to Cicero, she also participated in at least one of the engagements last year or earlier this year?
Yeah, once in a while she comes and speaks, and she tells the story of going to Michael Jackson's ranch and so forth, and she shares her story as a friend of Ryan's and the things that they got to do together. Ryan used to always say, well, I'll do it if Heather can go. So Heather got to go and travel a lot with Andrea and I, too.
To New York and to California primarily, right?
Yes, to do media and to do black tie events and fundraisers for AIDS, really, kind of. Ryan was quite the spokesperson for the AIDS epidemic, so yes.
Yeah, I'd say that's an understatement. and we won't, I'm assuming that most people listening are familiar, and if they're not familiar with Ryan, your speeches and your telling of the story is available online in videos and whatnot, so we won't get into all of his story, because I'm assuming people kind of more or less know about it, and also, as we just were talking about, when you tell it, you relive it, and it's a very emotional experience as well, even 27 years later. So I imagine it's got to feel tough sometimes to kind of keep going back to the well, so to speak. Did you ever find yourself getting particularly exhausted when you're out speaking a lot during those busier times of the year?
Yes, I'm very exhausted over it. I mean, reliving your story, I think, and the ups and the downs, and then Ryan's passing. I think it's just very hard to relive all the time. But at the same time, I think it's very educational for people not to forget the AIDS epidemic and the crisis the hemophilia community endured during the 80s especially. I mean, it wasn't just Ryan. It was so many hemophiliacs and their whole families being infected by this. And so I think it's important to keep that memory and those memories of all the people that were loved. I think it's really good to keep them remembered.
And that's a perfect segue into the kind of main topic that we're here to talk about, which is the event coming up at World AIDS Day this year. at the AIDS Memorial Grove out in San Francisco.
I'm really proud to be a part of the AIDS Memorial Grove. They're honoring the hemophilia community, which is the Hemophilia Federation, COT, and the National Hemophilia Foundation. And I think it's really neat to have a memorial that there is a place that stories can be remembered and the legacy of all these people that lived and died from hemophilia and AIDS. So they'll have a memorial to where they can visit yearly. I think the hemophilia community has wanted a memorial for so long now. And this doesn't, intersect anything that somebody else might want to do. It's just that I mentioned to Johns many years ago about it would be neat to have a hemophilia, a representation of the hemophilia community somewhere there in the Grove.
John being the executive director
of
the Grove.
John Cunningham. And so, I know there's been a lot of people that's wanted to do different things, but we had a meeting in Santa Clara. The Hemophilia Federation had a meeting in Santa Clara, and I had a meeting with a bunch of people who were interested in doing a memorial and wanting me to get involved. And I asked them if they had been to the Grove, and they had no idea what I was talking about. And I was kind of surprised about that. But it is an AIDS Memorial Grove, and I think that there was that thought at the time, I think, that they wanted their own memorial. But this is an AIDS memorial, and it it introduces all the aspects of how people got AIDS, from the gay community to the hemophilia community, and eventually we want to focus on people who got it from maybe just blood transfusions. So I think this is just one aspect, I think, that I feel that will enable hemophiliac story to live on and on and on. I think a museum is planned later on in years, and it's like the Holocaust Museum. I think that we want to make sure, like 50 years down the road, there is somewhere that we can share these stories, and so people can remember the epidemic and the pain and agony that the hemophilia community went through during that time. So, I mean, I'm really proud to be a part of it. I hope the other hemophiliac community, the rest of the hemophiliac communities will be as honored as I am to be participating in this event.
Yeah, I think that's a point that I think is really important, that 50 years from now, how are people interacting with what happened? And the Grove being a place that already honors so many people. I mean, I'm looking at the site here, millions of people that the Grove has touched. That seems to be a great central point for the stories to be collected. And the hemophilia community's story is a large part of the AIDS epidemic. I mean, Ryan himself was largely responsible for helping the CDC identify that this was in fact a bloodborne virus, mm-hmm. and a blood transferred virus. I do understand the people who say, well, we still want our own thing for what happened to us. And I think I agree with you that this doesn't need to be in place of that. This is simply giving the hemophilia community the opportunity to be recognized within the largest AIDS memorial that the country has in a really specialized way, which I think for our community is really important.
I think that we need to look at the longevity of a memorial. And this memorial is here as a permanent thing. And we know it will be funded. It's on Nancy Pelosi Boulevard. And the California and San Francisco community, I think, will ensure it's around a lot of other museums. And I think in the long run, the longevity of our story being told is definitely at the AIDS Memorial Grove.
The HIV Story Project in general, what is the idea? How are they collecting the stories?
Well, the AIDS Memorial Grove, they did the storytelling at the National Hemophilia Conference, and they're doing it several places. They have done several private storytelling events at the Grove even. I know they did Val Baez, they did me, they did Philip Kukab. But there's been a variety of people who have already shared their story, and we want more. We want, from people sending in their own videos or whatever, we want the whole hemophilia community to be represented as best as we can for future generations.
And how can people who are interested in contributing get involved? Do you know, do they contact the HIV Story Project through their website, or is there another way that people listening who might be interested in contributing could participate?
The HIV Story Project, I think, would be the best to the AIDS Memorial Grove. I think contact them and ask them what is required. If you want your story told and remembered, to please contact them and see what we can do. We'd like to have the support of everyone. And as far as, especially on World AIDS Day, they're celebrating the hemophilia community. And it's not just the National Hemophilia Foundation. I want everybody to remember, it's the Hemophilia Federation. And it's also COT. So I think it's, you know, they're being honored. All three organizations are being honored, not just one, not saying one is more important than the other.
Right.
It's everybody.
Right.
I mean, and the hemophilia community in general, I would love to have their support.
Hey, sorry to interrupt this interview with Jeannie. We will be right back to that in a moment, but I got to talk to you real quick about Entertainment to Affect Change. Entertainment to Affect Change is a 501c3 nonprofit organization dedicated to creating impactful and educational photo, video, film, and audio content that leads to positive change in the world. Entertainment to Affect Change, or E2AC, has actually helped bring this podcast to life by partnering with Believe Limited to make Bloodstream a reality, but they do a lot more than podcasts. Check out e2ac.org to see some of the awesome content they've been creating, including a documentary on a groundbreaking organization that aims to help children who stutter learn to love their stutter and themselves. E2AC.org. E2AC. Entertaining to Affect Change. Bloodstream would once again like to recognize Stop the Bleeding. Stop the Bleeding, the comedic web series about bleeding disorders that uses entertainment and digital content to educate and empower our community. You can find all of the episodes and our additional content, such as the behind-the-scenes videos and our unique STB activity book, by visiting our website, stbhemo.com. That's S for Samuel, T for Thomas, B for Bravo, Hemo for hemophilia, stbhemo.com. I want to read a selection of words that I picked out from some stuff that has been written about Ryan, characteristics, and just kind of get your take on these. Blunt, disarming, normal, wise, graceful, quick thinking, steely resolve, effective, determined, stubborn, poised, relentlessly upbeat. Do those sound accurate? You're smiling. Do those sound generally accurate to you?
I think spoiled was in there somewhere, too. but Ryan had charm. He had charm. But I think because of the way he dealt with everything, he didn't dwell on his disease. He dwelt on doing things and having a future. And so I don't think that, you know, I think he had all those qualities. But at the same time, I think he was really sincere in, he really wanted to go to school. And I can remember the attorney asking Ryan, you know, do you really want to go to school that bad? And Ryan said, yes. He said, it could get ugly. Ryan said, I can take it. So I think the more challenges that was put in front of him, the more he fought to achieve those.
Well, and in reading his book, he references how living with hemophilia, he had been living all his life with a disorder that made him different, mm-hmm. that meant he had to go about life a little bit differently, that he was going to struggle to participate in things like sports in a big sports state like Indiana. And I can identify with that, because I feel like the hemophilia-related challenges that I had, especially as a kid when I had inhibitors and was bleeding a lot, missed a lot of school, had trouble keeping friendships because I was gone so much, I think that's prepared me well for challenges that you face in life. Obviously, I've never faced something like what Ryan has. Very few people will. But it does help prepare you. And I hear families talk about that, how having hemophilia and learning how to manage it teaches you about how much strength that you have and how much resolve you truly have, because it's a necessity.
I think with Ryan being in having severe hemophilia with less than 1% clotting, I think by being in the hospital at Riley Hospital and seeing kids a lot worse off than him growing up. I mean, when you're 4 and 5 years old and you see kids who are mentally, physically handicapped. Mm-hmm. And Ryan used to say, I'm just thankful all that's wrong with my hemophilia. And then to keep growing up with hemophilia, I mean, he saw constantly kids worse off than him. And it takes a special thing in your life, I think, to that I'm just grateful, you know, right. That my hemophilia. Then you learn to deal with hemophilia. And all of a sudden something else comes along and it's like, oh, brother, he said, well, this is just something else I got to deal with.
Right,
you know?
Right.
So I think instead of completely feeling sorry for yourself, you know, think, how am I going to live with this? How mm-hmm. am I going to deal with this? You mm-hmm. know, how am I going to be able to carry on my life the way I am?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that instead of being negative, oh, feel sorry for me, or I can't believe this has happened to me. I think that was never Ryan's attitude. It's just, well, this is something else I got to deal with.
And it's never been your attitude either. We spoke about this before, but never, you know, never wanting to play or be perceived as playing the single mom card and not the woe is me card. You were cognizant to not put that kind of energy out there yourself.
Well, you know, I had a job at General Motors. I mean, I wasn't a foreman or anything like that, but I had a good paycheck. I had good insurance, which I had to keep. I mean, my health insurance, I think, was very important to me to always know that I had a job. But, I think it's important to know that you know, to carry on. I mean, just, you know, everybody says, you know, we're saying, oh, well, you know, I didn't dwell on, well, let me say this. I didn't dwell on being a single mom because I felt like when I left my husband, it was the best thing for our family. And I thought our life was going to be better off if I left him. And it was. And so I felt like that's a strong commitment to make, I think, to think. It's scary. It's mm-hmm. scary, especially if you always, you know, had somebody, you know, to depend on. All of a sudden, you're responsible for everything.
Right.
But I think that enabled us to do a lot more things than we would have been able to do had I been married.
Sure.
When Ryan eventually got AIDS, I think I was a decision maker. And it was rough. I mean, you wanted somebody to cry and give you a hug every night, you know, and say everything's going to be okay. But I had my kids, and my kids were everything to me. So I think, as you know, we had each other, and I think, you know, that is what got us through, is we did have each other and my family, my mom and dad. I can't say enough about my mom and dad, their support and the decisions I make, even though they didn't maybe approve of all of them. You know, I think that they were very supportive of my children and helping them do what the things that they wanted to do and be creative, in their own life.
So in the last 26, well, actually, let's talk a little about the Ryan White Care Act, because I think that's something that people hear about, but maybe don't really fully understand what it is. So can you tell us a little bit about what the Ryan White Care Act is and how Ryan became associated with this piece of legislation?
When Ryan was in the hospital, very ill, he was a nightly media story for about a week and a half. The media was camped out at the hospital. And so it was a nightly news story, and Senator Kennedy, they were having these first hearings on a CARE Act, on a bill about AIDS. And Senator Kennedy called the hospital, and Elton John, who was at the hospital and was a very, very dear friend of mine, was my guardian angel, so to speak. He said, this is a call I think you should take, because he was kind of monitoring the phone calls that were coming in. And it was Senator Kennedy, and he said, you know, no one has brought so much attention to this disease. This is the first chance we have of making a difference for people with AIDS. Would it be all right if we named this bill the Ryan White Care Act? And I thought, oh my gosh, I thought that'd be nice. That would, not ever knowing how enormous that bill would become, and that 26 years later, it is still in existence, and we have meds now, and we have drugs to keep people alive, and so the bill was initially designed for drugs, care, and treatment for people who don't have insurance, to make sure that they get into some kind of health care and prevention mode, so to speak. So, and it's continued today, and I just could not be more proud to represent with HRSA and continue Ryan's legacy. And that has been probably one of the biggest things that has ever been done in Ryan's name is the Ryan White Care Act.
It says here on HRSA's website that approximately 52% of all diagnosed with HIV in the United States have benefited from the Ryan White Care Act. More than half of people with AIDS in the United States. That's incredible.
I mean, just to think that the meds are available now, when we had no meds at all available for Ryan for his 5.5 years. We had AZT, which ended up kind of destroying your body instead of helping your body. But to think now that people can live, and you're a part of that, just a small part of that. And Ryan did make a difference. He made the disease to where people could talk about it, and he educated the public about AIDS. So, and you know, I think that Ryan started all this, and he gave such a commitment of his own life to help other people. And even though he lost his life, he is still being remembered by helping so many other people live with AIDS today.
Do you ever feel pressure to keep up Ryan's work? Does it ever feel like it's pressure to do so?
Yeah, I think it does. I mean, you don't want to mess up.
Right.
And I once told Senator Kennedy, I'm afraid I would hurt the cause more than help the cause if I got involved. And he said, no. He said, everybody has a mom, and we're going to approach this disease differently. He said, just be a mom. And Senator Hatch said, just be a mom. And he said, I have 25 senators lined up for you. Just be a mom and you'll be okay. And so, I mean, I never felt like I was anything more than just a mom speaking on behalf of losing her son. But at the same time, I think it's made it real for people. People have a story to relate to and to learn from. And I hope... that I don't hurt the cause ever instead of help the cause.
Oh,
for hemophilia and for AIDS.
It seems very hard to believe that you would ever hurt it more than help it, but I could understand that. You figure Ryan lived to 18 and he's been gone for 26 years now. You've been keeping up the cause for more years than he was even ever alive, which that's a long time. That's a lot of work. I just imagine there might be moments where it just feels like, I don't know if I can keep doing this, especially because it's so, you speak about it and you work from your heart in many ways. Does it feel depleting at times? Does it feel like you kind of empty the tank sometimes and just would like to find something else that you could be able to do that didn't maybe tax you emotionally so much?
Well, I try to space my speeches apart because it is emotionally draining. At times I could do maybe 2 or 3, and at the Children's Museum I've done that before, and I finally can't do that.
Yeah.
I have to space them now, and it's just maybe it's age or something, but it's emotional draining to tell your story and to be fresh, and I don't have this prepared speech, so I speak kind of to my audience and as a mom who watched her son live and die from AIDS, and so. But the hemophilia story is a big component because Ryan had hemophilia a lot longer than he had AIDS. So a lot of times people, because he became famous because of AIDS, they forget that, you know, he still had severe hemophilia. He had to live with that too. So that's quite a tackle for a person to live with, being a severe hemophiliac and then getting AIDS and having to live with AIDS too. So It was a strain, and even talk about it sometimes. It's very emotional, and sometimes I wonder, you know, how I can do another one.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And then I go home, and I come home to my family, my husband, my daughter, and I usually spend Saturdays together, and so it's a real, you know, you get back to your normal life, and then I can remember Ryan saying, you know, Mom, just don't use those big fancy words, and you'll be okay.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, do it a job. I remember Andrea one time, what if you do it like a job and don't bring it home every night with you? And I think I didn't realize how every day we were living AIDS every day.
Yeah.
And so even though I feel like it's a learning, and I'm teaching and I'm sharing my story, it's something that I feel like I don't want to dwell on. And I don't want to live in pain and agony. So we talk about miracles, and Ryan lived 5.5 years with AIDS, and he was only supposed to live 3 to 6 months. And everybody says, you know, do you believe in miracles? And well, I had a miracle. I didn't see it at the time that I had Ryan for 5.5 years when so many people were dying in such shorter length of time than Ryan.
Right.
Most people were not living more than a year. And to have Ryan with me for 5.5 years, that was a miracle, but I couldn't see it at the time. But I see the miracle and everything else that he's done in his life. The Ryan White Care Act, the people that he touched. So I feel like I've kind of got a miracle, but I just couldn't see it at the time.
What compelled you to, because people may not realize you were not actively involved with the hemophilia community for a long time because, frankly, the hemophilia community turned their back is too harsh a term, but when you reached out for help in the mid-80s, those you reached out to didn't provide any help, and people wanted to distance themselves a bit from you and from Ryan and from the Association of Hemophilia and AIDS. So there was a long period where you weren't a part of the hemophilia community, and that has obviously changed dramatically. But I don't think we've ever talked about what brought you to the hemophilia community again.
Well, when we felt like the support would be there within the hemophilia community when Ryan was diagnosed with AIDS, the hemophilia community was in denial. Every time I called, I talked to attorneys, they said, we're a hemophilia foundation, not an AIDS foundation. So therefore, we did not have the representation or the support of the hemophilia community. And in fact, there was a lot of people said that we brought a lot of bad publicity to the hemophilia community because we introduced the fact that hemophiliacs had AIDS. And so that was never our intent. We knew that if Ryan was infected, everybody else had to be infected, at least from Riley Hospital, because we all got our factor from the same place.
Right.
So we knew, I mean, like you're talking about hundreds and hundreds of people in Indiana even. So therefore, it was kind of knowing that this was a hemophilia problem, but did not have the support of the hemophilia community. But about 5 years ago, it's been long, about 7 years ago now, I was asked to come back. Val Baez, they were having in Indiana, they were having a hemophilia walk, and I was asked. They asked me if I would come join their walk and share my story. So I went, and from that point on, more hemophiliac communities, different states were asking me to come. I started speaking more at Hemophilia Federation. Mm-hmm. I spoke at an event there. So, I mean, it just kind of, I don't know. So I don't want to say snowball, because it was a gradual introduction, I think, to being back in the hemophilia world, because Ryan had hemophilia a lot longer than he had AIDS. And
yeah. And it's interesting to watch the way people respond to you and to your stories, and in particular, the parents in rooms that I've been in where you've talked, to watch the parents of people who have had HIV AIDS or are still living with it. They identify on such a deep level. I think it's very cathartic for them to hear you speak in a setting of people with hemophilia. Do you get people's comments that reflect that?
I think so many people feel like they can't, because it brings up sadness.
Mm.
I think a lot of people think they can't talk about that person that they've lost.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's so important. I'm fortunate because I can talk about Ryan and people want to know more and people listen.
Mm-hmm.
But afterwards, I have so many mothers that come up and say, I wish I could share my child story too, you know, and I say, try it, you know, share your story. So I think that it's, people would like to, for people to be remembered. And I'll never forget Barbara Bush after Ryan's funeral, or before Ryan's funeral, it was before, we were in this little green room, and she said, this is something you'll never get over. She said, I lost a little girl to cancer. And I had no idea that. I mean, that, and so, you know, this is something as a mother, especially, and I'm not a father, so I don't know. But I imagine it's the same way. But yeah, as a mother, I can tell you this is something you'll never get over. People said it gets easier, and it doesn't. You learn to live with it because you have to, not because you want to.
Do you find sometimes, I mean, we're talking a little bit about the pressure of telling the story and how it can be emotional, but do you also find it sometimes very cathartic?
I find sometimes it's great therapy for me. You know, to especially is, even though I scrapbook Ryan's life and, you know, and all this, sometimes that's very emotional. Mm-hmm. But sometimes when I even just finish a scrapbook, it's kind of therapy that I want to remember the good times too. Everything is not about the bad times. And, right. You know, I think we really kind of need to focus on good times, and however you can do that. If you can do it by scrapbooking or by telling your child's story or sharing it with another loved one, I think that's what we have to do. I say, make it a good time.
Yeah.
You know, we're all not going to live forever. So we're, you know, as Ryan used to say, you know, if I die, I know I'm going to a better place. And if I die, this is just another step up to it. So, I mean, I think we need to kind of look at this as another step up to it. It's how we make our life and what we do with our life that really counts.
Well, Jeannie, thank you for spending part of your life today here talking with me for this thing.
Thank you, Pat.
Entertainment to Affect Change, or E2AC, the nonprofit organization, seeks to improve the quality of life for people with exceptional health circumstances by utilizing the strength of new media, social media, live performance, film, and art to destigmatize difference, educate on health and wellness, and inspire individuals to improve self-care and pursue fulfilling lives. Visit e2ac.org to learn more about the organization, their mission, and their work. Once again, that's e2ac.org. After speaking with Jeannie, I contacted John Cunningham, the executive director of the AIDS Memorial Grove, and asked him if he could share some info with me, so I could share it with you, about this Surviving Voices campaign and the work that the AIDS Memorial Grove is doing with the HIV Story Project and how exactly the hemophilia community fits into that. And this is what he shared with me. I'm going to read it word for word. This oral history project ensures that the stories of the epidemic are captured and made available to future generations. Although steeped in tragedy and prejudice, the story of AIDS is rich in its relentless determination and powerful in its success. It is a story with abundant lessons for current and future generations as they confront their own social justice challenges. The AIDS story, from the first recognized cases in 1981 to now, is a story of communities conscious raising, hope, and determination. Through decades of denial and avoidance by government and society, to the anxious realization that the epidemic was out of control, communities gained their voices, expressed their outrage, and took action. This story will empower communities for generations to come, but only if it's known. The National AIDS Memorial will ensure that it is told with reverence and dignity, and that our lost brothers and sisters will never be forgotten. Our work this year will articulate the tragedies and triumphs of the national hemophilia community, half of which perished between 1980 and 2010 due to tainted blood supply, and will include stories of those who were lost and those who managed to survive, in addition to family and friends who witnessed loved ones perish helplessly. It's not the most uplifting thing to share toward the end of this episode, but as I said earlier, AIDS in America is not over. 50,000 new cases every year, 12,500 in people 13 to 25. And it's also important that our community in particular always keep in mind what went on, and not just out of respect to those who have perished and to those who are living with HIV and hepatitis C for that matter as well, but because it's a reminder, the story of advocacy to the point made by John, that relentless determination and the success, in my opinion, culminating in the Ryan White Care Act, this gigantic federally funded program to make sure that no matter what, you had access to care if you had HIV/AIDS. That is a success in the face of terrible challenge. And that's a lesson worth remembering. Because we are facing our own social justice problems today, and we as a hemophilia community, a bleeding disorders community, individual families, challenges never go away. So stories about how the most profound challenges found resolutions through groups of people, communities working together toward a common goal and facing fear, anger, and hate with an open mind, an open heart, and a willingness to educate. That goes a long way. And that's a story worth being told. So I'm thankful that the HIV Story Project is telling that story, and that this year they are spotlighting the hemophilia community and our unintended major role in HIV/AIDS. So thank you to John and the Grove for that. You can learn more about the HIV Story Project and the AIDS Memorial Grove by visiting AIDSMemorial.org. I want to give a big thank you to Jeannie Weikender for hosting me at her home in Florida and sharing some of her downtime talking about her work. Whenever I spend time with Jeannie, I walk away feeling like I have a greater sense of purpose in the world and a drive to be a better person. So thank you, Jeannie, and thank you, Ryan, for all that you do. And that is all for this episode. You can subscribe to Bloodstream on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, or wherever you're listening. And if you're already subscribed, thank you for that. Please, again, consider leaving us a review on iTunes. Reviews help other people find the podcast. Get in touch with us. We want to hear what you want us to talk about. And you can tell us that by emailing mailbag@bloodstreampod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/bloodstreampod, or connect with us on Twitter @bloodstreaminfo. You can bug me personally on Twitter @PJLynch. Bloodstream is written by Patrick James Lynch and edited by Ryan Geelan, produced by Patrick James Lynch, Ryan Geelan, Rob Bradford, and Andrew Gall, and the podcast is edited by Andrew Gall. Special thanks to everyone at Believe Limited and the National Hemophilia Foundation, our presenting sponsor, Stop the Bleeding, and our supporting sponsor, Entertainment to Effect Change, and the Hemophilia Alliance for helping us get this podcast started. Remember to check out the program notes for this episode in your podcast player or on bloodstreampod.com for all the links and additional information about the various stories featured on this episode. My name is Patrick James Lynch, and until next time, take self-care of yourself.